From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Christopher Walken. He likes to say he's from the planet showbiz. He's been performing since he was a child. We'll talk about how he went from being a song and dance kid to playing menacing characters in movies. The Republican Party now has a vice presidential candidate with a lesbian daughter and a platform with several anti-gay planks. We'll get reactions from two ends of the spectrum, the Traditional Values Coalition, a Christian group, and the Human Rights Campaign, a gay rights group. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews convention coverage from what he's seen on his wall of 11 TV sets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Christopher Walken started his acting career as a child, but as an adult, he's played many characters you might not want your child to see, characters that are both menacing and oddly funny. There's often something strange and unpredictable about his performances, which is part of the reason he has such a devoted following. After appearing in the films Next Stop Greenwich Village and Annie Hall, Walken won an Academy Award for his portrayal of a self-destructing Vietnam veteran in The Deer Hunter. He's played heavies in James Bond and Batman movies, but he also continues to make independent films, such as his new one, The Opportunists. Walken plays an ex-con who's trying to live the straight life, working as a mechanic. But he gets in debt and doesn't want to accept a loan from his girlfriend, played by Cyndi Lauper. She figures that if he refuses her loan, his only other option will be another heist. So she throws him out of her house.
Oh, maybe you ought to stay at your place for a while.
What do you mean?
Well, you got some kind of scheme, don't you?
No.
Yeah, well, there are people who rely on you. And you've been a regular citizen for a while now, and we all got used to you being around.
The regular citizen thing is not going too good.
Get out.
You mean that?
I'm not getting on a bus to go visit you upstate, Vic.
You're gonna be that way?
Yeah.
I'll come back tomorrow. I'll get my stuff. I am out the door.
And leave the keys.
Christopher Walken, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
Although the regular citizen thing isn't working out for you quite in this new movie, and you're about to get involved with another heist, you've really tried to, to hold down a job and be a regular guy and have a clean life. And this is a comparatively regular guy kind of role for you. Tell me what attracted you to this character and why you wanted to accept it.
Well, as you say, he's a man with a, a house and a family and children and essentially a good person, I think. And it's true, I don't get to play those kind of people very often. I often play various kinds of monsters.
Exactly. Both supernatural and more down-to-earth kinds of monsters.
Yeah.
And how does that suit you? I mean, do you like playing those roles?
Oh, absolutely. And this movie was made in the neighborhood that I grew up in, and in Queens and around Brooklyn. And I knew a lot of the old streets, and parts of the movie were literally shot blocks from where I was born. So that's only happened to me once before. I made a movie called The King of New York, and a lot of it was shot out where I used to live. In both those cases, I, at the end of the day, I would just go home. And that's nice.
Your wife, Georgianne Walken, is a casting director. She's, for instance, cast The Sopranos. If she were casting you in all your roles, would you be getting as many monster kind of roles?
I don't know. It's funny that it's never come up, but also she's never offered me a job, so maybe that's down the pike someplace.
That's right.
I don't know, maybe she's saving one for me, but she hasn't given me a job yet.
Let me play.
I'll have to speak to her.
Yeah, I think you should. Let me play another scene from one of your movies, and this is King of New York. And this is, I think, more typical of the kind of role that you get, where you're the heavy of one sort or another. And in this, you're a drug dealer who's just come out of prison. And to let everyone know you're back, you stop in on some of the competition and tell them that you want a piece of the business.
From here on, nothing goes down unless I'm involved. No blackjack, no dope deals, no nothing. A nickel bag gets sold in the park. I want in. You guys got fat while everybody starved on the street. It's my turn.
You think you're gonna live long enough to spend that money, you f***ing hump?
If any of you tired of getting ripped off by guys like that. You come with me. I'm at the Plaza Hotel. You're welcome. You're welcome! Enjoy.
Now, in that movie, you play the kind of character who can be pretty sadistic and is like amused by his own sadism, which is the kind of character you've played. And your characters all have this great verbal flair. I guess that's part of good writing for any movie. But I'm wondering where this kind of character starts with you, where your understanding of this kind of character comes from.
I don't know. I think if you get a kind of a ball rolling, and whatever it is, whether you're the funny guy or the romantic guy or the villain or whatever, if you're lucky enough to get that going, you could end up being asked to play that sort of person a lot. I think it's just an economic fact of life in the movies. Then occasionally you get lucky and get something else, something different, kind of like the movie I'm in right now.
The Opportunists.
The Opportunists. Or I've gotten to do a few musicals, so I've gotten to do different things, but it's true that I early on started playing, strange or villainous people.
Were there people who you observed as a child who seemed strange and villainous or who seemed particularly unhealthy or morally bankrupt who interested you and you observed?
No, and I can't think of people like that, but somebody suggested to me that it started with Annie Hall. It's one of the first things that I did. It's a great movie, and it's one of the first movies I did, and a lot of people saw it, and it was a wonderful movie. But I played, essentially a suicidal character, a guy who wants to drive his car into traffic. And it's an interesting idea that maybe that's how I got on that oddball foot, you know.
Well, I'm glad you brought up that role. We happen to have a clip standing by. Uh-huh. And this is one of Woody Allen's early movies. He plays a young aspiring stand-up comic. Diane Keaton plays, and he's like the Jewish neurotic urban guy. Diane Keaton plays the neurotic goyish Midwesterner. And in this scene, Woody Allen's visiting her family home in the Midwest. At night, he passes you in your bedroom, and you make this confession to him.
Can I confess something? I tell you this because, as an artist, I think you'll understand. Sometimes when I'm driving on the road at night, I see two headlights coming toward me. Fast, I have this sudden impulse to turn the wheel quickly, head on into the oncoming car. I can anticipate the explosion, the sound of shattering glass, the flames rising out of the flowing gasoline.
Right. Well, I have to go now, Dwayne, because I'm due back on the planet Earth.
And of course, in the next scene, it's pouring out, and you're driving a very frightened Woody Allen to the airport. It's funny, your lines on that about imagining driving into an oncoming car. I bet a lot of people have imagined that for split seconds in cars.
Poor Dwayne. it's that, it's that crazy thing where you anticipate annihilation for a second. It's better not to dwell on that sort of thing.
Now, you've said that you hate guns, but you've been in your share of films in which you have to use a gun or in which a gun is held on you. Is it ever troubling for you to be in a film with a lot of gunplay?
Yeah, again, that seems to be, the kind of movies that I do. I'd love to make a movie without guns and be a kind of a Fred McMurray character, with a house and a family and kids and a good job and jokes, a movie with jokes. I've gotten to do some of those. But, and in fact, as I get older, that seems to be happening. Now, for a long time, I was doing the other thing, but now I seem to be getting parts for people's uncles, you know, and dads and so on. That's a nice turn for me.
My guest is Christopher Walken. His new movie is called The Opportunists. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Walken, and he's starring in the new film, The Opportunists, which is an independent film. You've said that you grew up on the planet show business. You started in show business as a child. What were you, like three years old or something?
Well, real young. My brothers and I were in the show business at that time, and that was the birth, really, of network television, and it all happened in New York City, in and around Rockefeller Center, and they used a lot of kids, particularly at holiday time. I couldn't say that we were actors, but we were there. We were performers. In fact, when I do Saturday Night Live now, I had spent a great deal of time on that floor of NBC, the eighth floor. As a kid, I know all the nooks and crannies there, and you know, I know that area very well, and a lot of those shows came from within five blocks of Rockefeller Center.
You know, I think many of us grew up with the idea that stage mothers are like the mother in Gypsy, where it's like a woman who's really kind of controlling and possessive and manipulative, who really wanted to be in show business herself and couldn't do it, so she's living her show business life through her children. Would your mother have fit that image at all?
Well, I think my mother definitely had a passion for show business, still does. But it wasn't, as I say, such an unusual thing for kids to go to dancing school and then get on the subway and go to New York and be an extra on some TV show. And I remember that the kids in those days, one wanted to be what they called a triple threat. That meant you could sing, you could dance, you could remember your lines, and people who could do that stood a better chance of getting the job than the other guy. And the pay wasn't much, but it was a lot of fun, and there were a lot of people who did that, and it was a sort of a community. I'm very grateful to that. It was an education for me that I couldn't possibly have had anywhere else, and in fact, I don't think I'd be an actor today if I hadn't done that as a kid.
Well, at the same time that you were the show business kid and your mother was taking you through the show business route, your father owned a bakery, which I believe you and your brothers were expected to work in when you were young. Was that idea of the working world really different from, like, the show business idea of the working world? I mean, you were in both of those worlds at the same time.
Yeah. But they were only 15 minutes apart on the subway. And I did a lot of different things as a kid. But I think the word work is I heard you say it a few times. That's pretty much what it was, the idea of working, which I still feel is very important. I just try to work as much as I can. And it may be a holdover from those days. My father used to work very hard.
Because you went to children's professional school and spent a lot of your time acting professionally, are there parts of what was considered normal children's lives that mystify you, that you were just, like, not a part of?
Well, it's true. I don't know much about baseball or football, or, you know, I can't hardly swim. The sports thing wasn't that present where I went to school, but I'm not sure it was for anybody who grew up in Manhattan. There's just no room to play football. The closest thing to baseball I remember was stickball. You used to play it in the street with a rubber ball and a broom handle. So that part of it was a little different. On the other hand, I can dance. There's a whole generation, I think, of people who grew up in the neighborhood that I grew up in, who are probably about my age now, who can tap dance. Going to tap dance class was not unusual, whereas now it probably is.
For any of our listeners interested in seeing you dance, let me recommend the movie Pennies from Heaven, in which you have a part as a pimp who does a really menacing striptease kind of dance on top of a bar. It's a terrific sequence.
And the man who choreographed that number, Danny Daniels, was my tap teacher when I was 12 years old.
Oh, you're kidding.
And so, you know, many, many years later, they asked him if he knew an actor who could tap dance, and he said, yeah, I know the guy.
See, your mother said the lessons would pay off.
That's right.
We managed to get little dance moves sometimes into your movies. Like
I do. I try to fit in a little bit.
Like when you get out of prison in King of New York and you meet up with your boys again, you do, I don't know what the move would be called, but you do a few seconds of a little dance.
Yes. I've been told, you know, in fact, it's true that there's almost always a little dance I sneak in. I don't do it consciously, but it does end up being there.
Yeah, sometimes it looks like you're about to go into your dance, just into a dance, just when you're standing and about to.
Well, maybe I did, and they cut it. You know.
Right, right. Let me ask you about one of your early movie roles, and this is the role for which you won an Academy Award, and it's The Deer Hunter, in which you play, you know, a young man from an industrial town who goes to Vietnam, taken prisoner, and you're forced to play Russian roulette, to put a pistol to your head that has, you know, a couple of bullets in it, and you don't know when you fire whether one of those bullets is going to go off or whether you'll get an empty cylinder. You know, you're terrified at the beginning of this, you know, when you're forced to put the gun to your head and pull the trigger. That's a really long sequence, that first Russian roulette sequence in the movie. Tell me a little bit about what it was like to shoot it.
Well, when we made that movie, a lot of the physical circumstances were very authentic. And we were in Thailand, and that sequence you're talking about was actually shot in the River Kwai. So there was a reality going on that sometimes isn't always there if you're shooting on a soundstage or whatever. So the bugs and the snakes and everything were there, and it was hot, and I think that helped to make it all convincing.
Did the Russian roulette get to you at all?
Well, I'm very careful about that sort of thing. I'm the guy who checks the gun, you know, over and over, and so.
Let me play another scene. This is a scene from the movie The Comfort of Strangers, which was written and directed by Paul Schrader, who also wrote Taxi Driver. And in this movie, you play an Italian who takes two English tourists under your wing and then uses them in your sadistic sex life. Early on, they can tell there's something not quite right with you, but they're, you know, they're nice people and they don't want to jump to conclusions. So when you invite them to your house, they kind of show up in a state of confusion. The man played by Rupert Everett is with you in the room that used to be your father's study when he was a diplomat, and you start to tell him about your father. In fact, all of your stories in this movie seem to start with the words, "My father." Let's hear this scene.
My father and his father understood themselves clearly. They were men, and they were proud of their sex. Women understood them too. Now, women treat men like children because they can't take them seriously, but men, like my father, my grandfather, women took very seriously. There was no uncertainty, no confusion.
So, this is a museum dedicated to the good old days. Hmm?
Well, after you punch Rupert Everett in the stomach for no particular reason, then you wink at him. Was that wink in the script, or was that just a little Christopher Walken thing?
That was just one of those winks.
All your big stories in this movie start with "My Father," and your first "My Father" story is, I think, about 6 or 7 minutes long.
Yes, that was an enormous speech. It's a wonderful script written by taken from the Ian McEwan's book, but adapted by Harold Pinter, and the dialogue has a wonderful feeling to it. It's certainly a strange character I was playing, a disturbing sort of fellow.
Yeah, I think you once said that you found this character the most disturbing of all the characters that you've played.
I think that's true. I don't take things home with me that much. But he was I was glad to get rid of him.
What was particularly disturbing about this character?
Well, he was just so twisted.
Christopher Walken will be back in the second half of the show. His new film, The Opportunists, opens August 11th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Book Division, publisher of Dr. Murray's Total Body Tune-Up, Slow Down the Aging Process, Keep Your System Running Smoothly, Help Your Body Heal Itself for Life. This is NPR, National Public Radio. The Republican Party now has a vice presidential candidate with a gay daughter and a platform with several anti-gay planks. Coming up, we'll get reactions from a Christian traditional values group and a gay rights group. David Bianculli reviews TV coverage of the convention, and we continue our conversation with actor Christopher Walken. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Christopher Walken. He's starring in a new independent film called The Opportunists. Walken's line readings are sometimes very eccentric, with accents on words that other actors would be unlikely to accent. Kevin Spacey did an impression of Walken on Saturday Night Live in 1997. It was part of a sketch about the never-before-seen screen tests for the first Star Wars film. The sketch opened with Spacey playing Christopher Walken trying out for the role of Han Solo.
Okay, Chris, whenever you're ready.
I'm captain of the Millennium Falcon. Chewie here tells me you're looking for passage to the Alderaan system.
Yes, indeed, if it's a fast ship.
Fast ship? You've never heard of the Millennium Falcon. It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. She's fast enough for you, old man. That sucked. I'm sorry. I need a minute. Damn it. You know, I had it.
Did you hear this impression when it was broadcast?
Yes, I did. He's a friend of mine. He does it in front of me.
Really? Does it make you self-conscious?
No, I guess I'm flattered, you know, to have that. It's never seemed to me that I spoke in an odd way. But I guess I do.
So you're not consciously trying to put the accents on surprising words?
No, I think that's I have my own way of punctuating things, and I think that's really more than it is. It's not so much the way I speak as the rhythm of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. I have my own punctuation.
What do you mean by that? Do you like repunctuate a script when you get it?
I tend to ignore punctuation, actually. It's not that I do anything different. I just take it away. And then when I read things, I try to have them begin and end more or less where they do in my mind, as opposed to, you know, being told where that happens. It's kind of more interesting to figure it out yourself.
So do you think when you take away your punctuation in a script and say things in an unusual way, do you think it ends up maybe sounding more impromptu that way?
Well, it sounds more like me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think that's true. And scripts can very often be filled, I mean, not only over-punctuated by, you know, somebody wanting to make sure that it's spoken exactly the way they had in mind, but very often scripts are full of what they call stage directions, which not only tell you what it is you're saying and how to punctuate it, but it'll, you know, it'll have a line and it'll say in parentheses above it, he says despairingly, you know. Whenever I see that, I cross it out. Or if I see despairing, then I read the line happily. Or
having grown up in show business, do you think that having an acting career means something different for you than it would to, say, someone who grew up in a small town and dreamed someday of getting to Broadway or of someday making it to Hollywood? Because you kind of grew up with all of this.
Yeah, I think that my feeling about it always was and still is. I'm not as comfortable with the word actor as I am with the word performer. I've always thought of myself as a performer. You know, if I'm a good actor, that's kind of a bonus. But being a performer has always been more or less how I think of what I do.
Well, Christopher Walken, before you have to leave, I want to end with a clip, and I was hoping you could tell us about making the scene. And this is from a movie called At Close Range, in which you play a kind of small-time criminal. Your son is Sean Penn. You turn on your son's. You shoot Sean Penn's, your own son's girlfriend. You kill her. You're a really heartless guy in this. And by the end of the movie, Sean Penn is so upset at all the treacherous acts you've committed against your own family that he's holding a gun on you, his father. And he's so upset, he might really shoot you, and you're not sure how to play it. Before we hear that scene, tell us a little bit about what went into the making of this scene and what it's like for you as someone who doesn't really like guns to be in front of a gun on a movie set.
Yes, well, this story is based on a real family, and it's a terrible, sad story. When we shot this scene, I think I know what you're referring to. I've said it before, but I had a gun pointed at me, and at one point they switched the guns, and that was enough to put me in a panic. I didn't know really what was going on, although everything was being kept very safe behind my back. Just being in the dark about it got me into a huge anxiety attack. Anyway, that on film, you can see that. That's about all I can tell you.
And the other thing I like about the scene is that you're a character who's so incapable of being sincere. I mean, you're trying so hard to say to your son, I love you, and it just won't come out in a sincere way at all.
Yeah, well, I tried to be sincere.
Tried and failed, though, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. But that's in character.
Exactly. Christopher Walken, it's been a real pleasure. Good luck with your new film, and please make a musical one day.
Thank you, and it's always a pleasure to listen to NPR.
Oh, well, thank you for saying
that. And your program.
Is the gun you used to kill Terry?
I never did nothing to Terry.
Whoa! Whoa, wait! Is this the gun you used on everybody, on me? Family gun, Dad.
Jesus. Put that down. I've seen you.
You're gonna die. Come on. I know one thing clearer than I've ever known anything in my entire life, except that I loved Terry before you killed her. And that is that you're gonna die.
You got the guts to kill me? I'm your blood. I'm your family.
You're not my family, not anymore.
Yeah, you're crazy. Crazy, gone crazy.
Nope.
Listen!
What?
I know how it is. Cops got your neck, get your head all f***ed up. I know how that is.
My mind's simple, Dad.
Before they got you twisted, you must have known something, you must have felt it. I gave you money, I gave you a car, I took you in. But don't that mean something?
Means what? Means what?
It means I got feeling for you.
What feeling?
I care. What do you... I love you. What? Is that what you want to hear? I love you.
Yeah.
Mother...
I love you too, Dad.
Christopher Walken's new movie, The Opportunists, opens August 11th. Coming up, more on the Republican National Convention. This is Fresh Air. Last night, Dick Cheney accepted his party's nomination for vice president. The Washington Post reported last week that Cheney considered running for president 4 years ago, but decided against it in part because he wanted to protect a gay relative who didn't want to come out. That relative is his 31-year-old daughter, Mary. Now the Republican Party has a vice presidential nominee with a lesbian daughter and a platform with several anti-gay planks. We were curious about how people at different ends of the political spectrum would reconcile this. First, we called the Traditional Values Coalition, a Christian lobby group that opposes homosexuality. They have organized anti-gay initiatives in several states. We spoke with the coalition's founder and chairman, Reverend Lewis P. Sheldon. He lobbied at the Republican platform committee hearings. We reached him by phone yesterday at the Republican convention. I asked if the fact that Dick Cheney has a lesbian daughter changes Sheldon's feelings about the Republican ticket.
Well, absolutely not, because it hasn't changed Dick Cheney or Lynn Cheney's feelings at all about homosexuality. Dick Cheney still believes that homosexuality is inappropriate. He loves his daughter, and he's very much concerned about her. He treats her as a daughter with full respect, but doesn't mean that he is in any way decided that he wants to promote and advocate homosexuality as a viable life alternative. In the same way, you could compare this whole thing to what happened with Governor McGovern, excuse me, Senator McGovern, when his daughter was an alcoholic. Who eventually died, you know, from drinking. I would say it's the same kind of thing. It's a behavior-based lifestyle that parents, you know, sometimes have with their children.
Have you spoken to Dick and Lynn Cheney, and have they told you that that is their feelings about their daughter and their feelings about homosexuality?
Well, I spoke with Dick. It was not in recent months, no, but it's probably been a year or so ago before, you know, the whole vice presidential thing ever surfaced. And, you know, and he talked about the fact, you know, that this is a personal family thing, and that was the end of it, so I didn't discuss it any further.
Were you consulted on the choice of Dick Cheney?
No. But I was, I wasn't consulted at all, no. But I was asked about it after the fact in terms of my response, which was, I believe he's tremendous. He energizes the base. He's very strong. And we're very appreciative of what the Democratic National Committee has done in telling all of our public, saved us millions of dollars of postage and mailing, that Dick Cheney is very pro-life, very pro-family, and very conservative.
Will the fact that the vice presidential nominee has a lesbian daughter make it more difficult for the Republican ticket to take the kind of anti-gay stand that you want it to take?
Well, the Republican Party, the answer to the question is no, it will not, not in any way, shape, or form, because the platform very clearly stated that marriage should be between one man and one woman, not homosexual marriage or even civil union kind of relationship that Vermont has put forth. Second, the whole issue of gays in the military was stated that this is an inappropriate behavior, and it made reference to returning to the pre-1993 don't ask, don't tell. And third, it states very clearly in the platform that homosexuality should never be given special rights, preferred status in the law concerning any form of sexual orientation.
Now, what's your impression of how much traditional family values and anti-homosexuality will be a part of the Republican campaign this year? I mean, the emphasis has been on diversity, inclusiveness, the word compassion.
Well, I think that what you're going to have is it in a very soft sell manner. You're not going to have repeats of what Pat Buchanan said in 1992 in Houston, Texas. You will not have that. So I think what you're going to have is the kind of things you heard from Laura Bush and the kinds of things you heard from Elizabeth Dole. You're going to see a strong emphasis upon what is good and charitable and reasonable and for the whole nation.
No, the people who you mentioned haven't really discussed.
Well, did you hear their talks last night or Laura Bush's on Monday?
Yeah, she didn't discuss the issue of homosexuality.
No, but they talked. They didn't have to. They talked about, you know, the rights of parents, the issue of family values in a generic sense.
Now, what do you mean by soft sell?
Well, as I said, you remember what Pat Buchanan said? That was a little bit harsh. You don't want that.
Are you implying that you think the points are the same now as they were when Pat Buchanan spoke, but it's a nicer package now?
But the point is that the positions have not changed. We said that homosexuality is not a viable life alternative. It's not a viable life alternative. And we just have to realize that that's the position of most conservatives.
Why do you think that there is a more soft sell approach this time around?
Teddy Roosevelt said, speak softly, but carry a big stick. And Dick Cheney is a big stick. His yes is yes, and his no is no. And we all know where he stands, including every Democrat in America who is a political activist.
Reverend Lewis Sheldon is the founder and chair of the lobby group, the Traditional Values Coalition. We called Winnie Stackelberg, the political director of the Human Rights Campaign, a gay rights lobby group. The group is bipartisan. It has endorsed Al Gore for president. She says the policies espoused by Dick Cheney and George W. Bush are policies that would directly discriminate against Cheney's lesbian daughter.
Well, for example, when Governor Bush in the last legislative session in Texas, he supported a bill that would have denied Texas gays and lesbians from adopting children. He supported that bill that would have outlawed gay and lesbian adoptions. He opposed a bill that would have added sexual orientation to the hate crimes law. He does not support job protections, for example, for gays and lesbians. In other words, his policies that he has forwarded would say that the two daughters of the Cheneys, one of them, it would be okay to fire her for a unrelated factor like her sexual orientation, even if she's doing a good job at work. But the other daughter, that kind of discrimination is illegal. So I think that is now the conundrum that faces the Bush-Cheney ticket with the fact that one of the daughters is openly gay.
What about what the platform says?
Exactly. I think that's another interesting point. There was a huge platform fight on several planks having to do with domestic partnership, having to do with non-discrimination and the military. And again, what it does is it codifies the discrimination that exists and that now is a part of the Republican platform. It sort of puts that as a codification, and it really means that Mary Cheney, her father, as the second in command of that Republican Party, as the vice presidential candidate, is putting forward those positions as well. And I don't believe he does. I don't believe that he would like to see his own daughter discriminated against. And so it will be interesting to see over the next several weeks how the Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney respond to those kinds of questions.
Your group is a lobby group. How are you going to be using the fact that Cheney has a lesbian daughter in your work?
Well, I think that some of that will unfold over the next couple of weeks. I mean, whether Cheneys are treated equally, the two daughters are treated equally as the campaign goes forward, will Mary Cheney's partner, for example, be embraced and given the same kind of role as the other daughter's husband and family? I mean, we constantly are hearing Lynn Cheney talk about how proud she is of her daughters, and I think that's wonderful. But then she goes on to say, my married daughter and her grandchildren, and talks about that family situation. And I don't hear the same kind of discussions on the other side. And while I think we want to ensure that Mary Cheney has her privacy, this is no longer a private matter because of the public policy positions that are being forwarded by both Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney, the Republican platform, and the campaign generally. And so I think that these will be issues that we will address in the next few weeks and months, and hopefully be able to draw distinctions, continue to draw distinctions between the Bush-Cheney ticket and Al Gore and whomever he selects as his running mate.
I want to ask you more about that. I think that Mary Cheney has been very private about her homosexuality, and I think her parents would probably prefer to keep it that way, too. They have not seemed anxious to talk to the press about their daughter. What you're describing is talking about her in a more public way. Why do you think that's justified?
Well, I think Mary Cheney, in fact, has not been particularly private about her sexual orientation. She has been a member of the gay and lesbian community in Denver, Colorado, for a number of years. She had most recently a very public position with Coors Brewing Company as the gay and lesbian marketing manager. So again, she hasn't been private about her sexual orientation. She's been an active member of the community in Colorado. And while I think that we at the Human Rights Campaign want to be sensitive to her and to her family, I think that her sexual orientation puts the anti-gay positions of the Republican ticket in a particular light, and we would be disingenuous and I think irresponsible in some ways not to then talk about and to urge Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney to answer the questions about discrimination in the workplace and hate crimes legislation and equal benefits for gays and lesbians and adoption policies. I think those are issues that are now facing the gay and lesbian community in huge numbers. And as Republicans, I think they have a responsibility to answer those questions, made even more so now because of Mary Cheney. I mean, for example, on Tuesday night in the Republican convention, Jim Colby spoke, and he was protested by certain members of the Texas delegation. I mean, and again, will the Bush-Cheney folks speak out against that kind of overt display, that rejection that they received?
Winnie Stackelberg is the political director of the Human Rights Campaign, a gay rights lobby group. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews TV coverage of the Republican convention. This is Fresh Air. Tonight is the fourth and final night of the Republican National Convention, and TV critic David Bianculli insists it's been a truly historic event, not for what TV has shown, but for where it has shown it and what it hasn't bothered to show at all.
I should start out by explaining how I watch political conventions on TV, because a lot of people, especially those people at network news organizations who are upset about my opinions, ask me how I can flip through all the channels and assess the coverage fairly. Here's my secret. No flipping. I have a video wall set up with 11 TV sets and 11 VCRs so I can see everything at the same time. I can only hear three things at once without going nuts, but that's enough. By raising the volume on the individual TV sets whenever anyone interesting is talking, I can sample more than enough to run a fair taste test. So that's how I see it. Now here's what I see. For one thing, I see the same guests walking from one convention booth to another like they're running a soundbite relay race. Someone like Bob Dole or John McCain will pop up on MSNBC or Fox News Channel or CNN, then run the circuit of the other cable networks without a break. For another, I see the broadcast networks giving up so much ground, they've essentially given up. The arguments against blanket network coverage are simple and pretty persuasive. One, gavel-to-gavel TV coverage is provided both by PBS and C-SPAN, so political purists have access to the proceedings whether or not they subscribe to cable. Two, politicians of both parties have micromanaged these conventions to such a point that there's very little real news coming from them. And audience ratings for this current convention are so low that the networks can mount a strong argument that most people just aren't interested in watching. On the other side of the coin, though, is the argument that Americans can learn a lot about the respective parties and politicians by watching even an engineered convention. And also, since the broadcast network news organizations used to treat these events like political Super Bowls, they're still very competitive and high profile, even though CBS, NBC, and ABC devote less and less time to covering them. And that's where all this gets a little silly and stupid. Cable news outlets like CNN and Fox News Channel have nothing but time on their hands. So people like Jeff Greenfield at CNN and Britt Hume at Fox get to make all the points they want at their leisure. At CBS, NBC, and ABC, coverage the first three nights was shoehorned into existing news magazines or limited to one-hour specials. But because the broadcast networks have high-profile anchors and plenty of correspondents and political analysts on hand, the issue of exposure for the network people becomes more important than for the politicians. It can get absolutely ridiculous, as in this sample from ABC, when Cokie Roberts was reporting on the reaction to Colin Powell's opening night speech.
Again, reaching to the middle, reaching to women, reaching to moderate voters, talking about children, education, and then Colin Powell so dramatically talking about how the party couldn't just assume the mantle of Lincoln. It had to work for it. And people, I'm watching the faces of all the delegates from here, Peter. They were really moved by it and excited by it. I do think there's been something of a change, at least...
Now, I love Cokie Roberts, but this was more like Monty Python than ABC News. Here she is, commenting on how strong and moving a speech Powell is giving, while he's giving it. And we can't hear him, because he's being drowned out by her. CBS has been just as rushed, and NBC has been a virtual no-show, at least on broadcast TV. But if you turn to cable and the network's MSNBC sister network, you can see Tom Brokaw and Tim Russert holding court over the kind of coverage the big three networks routinely provided just 8 years ago. Wall to wall, with lots of time for coverage of selected speeches and entertaining analysis. CBS and ABC News are like racehorses that can't get out of the gate. They're in place, but they're no longer in the race. And NBC is running the way it used to, but on cable, where viewers aren't watching. MSNBC's ratings have been a lot lower than even Fox News Channel's. So even though Brokaw has found an escape route, it's a road to nowhere. And when he and the rest of NBC's A-team staff leaves, MSNBC becomes almost unwatchable. One thing MSNBC should do, starting with the Democratic convention in 2 weeks, is expand Brokaw's anchor shift another half hour. As it is, he leaves right after primetime coverage ends at 11, and that's when commentary and perspective are the most valuable. One thing CBS and ABC should do next time is to stop trying to squeeze convention coverage into existing news magazine slots. It doesn't work, and there's too little time devoted to conventions as it is. As for PBS, C-SPAN, CNN, and Fox News Channel, keep doing just what you're doing. The right viewers will find you. And for the apathetic ones, there's always UPN and WWF SmackDown. WWF champion The Rock did speak at the Republican convention last night, but it's the broadcast news networks that truly are caught between a rock and a hard place.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui Westman, with Megan Howell and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember writer William Maxwell, the former fiction editor of The New Yorker. He died this week at the age of 91. We'll feature an interview with him from the archive and speak with a writer he mentored, Alec Wilkinson. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.